Welcome to Bodcast, the Business of Dentistry podcast, brought to you by Practice Plan. Bodcast delivers the best business advice, real-life stories, and practical hints and tips to make your practice a more profitable and sustainable business. And now, here's your host.
Welcome to today's podcast. My name is Nigel Jones. I'm Sales and Marketing Director at Practice Plan. And with me is Judith Husband. And what we're going to be talking about today is some of the challenges that the profession are facing, both in terms of pressures from regulation, from the NHS, issues like that, but also wider issues going further afield into the future for amalgam, for example. So very welcome to you, Judith. Perhaps you could just introduce yourself and say a bit about your background.
Thank you, Nigel. I'm delighted to be here today. I'm a general dental practitioner and elected to the British Dental Association's Principal Executive Committee. And on that committee itself, I have the additional responsibility to the usual non-exec stuff of being chair to Education Ethics and the Dental Team Working Group, which is quite an incredible name, but it encompasses many areas of dentistry, and it's a very interesting and challenging area and also a group of individuals to be working with. We're an expert committee. So.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like gives you a great position from which to talk about some of the key challenges you see facing the profession. So what do you think those are at the moment?
I think at the forefront of most registrants' minds is the issues that we have had with the General Dental Council and ongoing concerns that we all have with regulation of individuals and also then broadening out to the additional burden of regulation that dental teams and dental practices face, both with CQC and the equivalents in the devolved nations. Moving forward, regulation will be continuing to be a hot topic, and it's an area that we can all still shape and contribute to because despite Brexit, the government have announced that they are still going to be releasing their consultation on regulation in the autumn, so imminently. We had some preliminary meetings in July. Granted, at that point, we didn't even know who was Minister for Health still at that point. Things are moving so quickly, but the decision recently has been announced that this consultation will be going out. It's not going to be looking just at dentistry, and this is something that I have been at pains to make certainly over the last couple of years, that the issues that we have with regulation and dentistry are not unique by any stretch. All of healthcare regulation, and even if we dare to branch out to our legal colleagues, everybody is facing this same pressure of increased expectations, increased demands from the public for openness with how we actually remain being a profession really and self-regulating. So I think it's important that we all keep an eye out in the next few weeks or month, because autumn tends to be a very long and broad time when governments are involved, because this consultation will be very important. It will potentially look at realigning the regulators, potentially combining functions, potentially making new ones or removing some.
One of the things that I've found quite interesting over the last few years with the way that regulation has gone is that there's this climate of fear, it seems, with the profession, where they're not being confident about how to interact with patients, what treatment options to put forward. There's this nervousness about being potentially subject to a fitness to practice. All those sort of things, do you feel that the way that the consultation is going will help address that and help improve confidence?
I would hope that the profession can understand it's not alone. I think it's very easy for us to become blinkered with our own significant issues and perhaps even see the other regulators as the solution. I heard it said many times a couple of years back over the ARF issues that, you know, we should all go to the GMC. Now, they're not a panacea. They don't have it perfect by any stretch, and any doctor will tell you that. So I think what will come to the fore will be just the broad aspects and the commonality that all the professions share. That should give us some hope as such, because, you know, we're all in it together as such. But I don't think it will address the stark fear that's out there in general practice. But I think the fear and the defence of dentistry that we know is going on in all its different senses, I think it's more complex. It's not purely down to the fear of a fitness to practice referral. There is the very real issue of litigation in this country that we all face. I mean, most of us have got a case ongoing at any one point. I certainly have. And that is impinging, and I see that as a much more complex issue, because again, that's not something really that the profession itself can manage. What we can do though is mitigate the risks, to know where the problems are, and to be able to arrange our practices, our teams, in such a way that we have the time, the space to do the dentistry that we need to do, to be able to cover consent fully, which does take time, to enable our patients perhaps for them to have the space as well. So there are aspects within it that we can do to protect ourselves, but then there is also the issue of having to become resilient, that this is the world.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, because certainly a number of the practitioners that I've spoken to, as you say, are very much going down the defensive route, and it feels an awful lot of that's because they haven't worked out how best to mitigate the risks that you were talking about.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether there's an opportunity to help them with that specific point more, as you mentioned about reconfiguring teams and getting consent properly understood, because it seems to me that there's an avoidance going on, and they're just playing it very, very safe rather than thinking, actually, no, there are ways that I could handle this. Is that your sense of it too?
Absolutely. I mean, certainly the indemnity organisations do provide very good training courses. It is in their interest as well to heighten the awareness as well. And it's a balance between heightened awareness and a realistic understanding of the risk. I've had recent conversations with senior members of the GDC, and they appreciate even that they have a role in assessing and highlighting to the profession what the main risk areas actually are, so that we can then work as a profession to mitigate those and to give people the tools in which to do it. My concern is, and knowing from being a hands-on clinician, is that often it's time. Time with our patients is what's most important, and the ability to defer treatments if necessary. So of course there are certain areas of dentistry, emergency dentistry, that cannot be deferred in that way, and that has its own challenges. But generally, most of dentistry can be discussed, thought about, questioned, mulled over, but it needs to be within a system where that space and that time exists.
Yeah, again, I think that's a really interesting point, because obviously there's lots of discussion in the past about how communication with patients is key to minimising complaints, and also the better relationship you've got with a patient, the less likely you are to be sued. But that does take time, as you say, and I've been struck by the correspondence that I've seen going on between the Federation of London LDCs and the GDC, where one of the phrases that stuck in my mind was when they spoke about adhering to gold standards, which would support the idea of better communication and better involvement and better consent, within the constraints of a tin-plated budget, I think was the phrase that was used. How do you see that tension between working in the NHS and professionalism evolving in the future?
I think there's an issue, and there always has been an issue, with the way dentistry is set up and run. We've always had the conflict and the tension between being a business and being a healthcare provider. And I don't think it's impossible to reconcile the two. There is never an excuse, and this is something that I say often, and it may upset people, but I don't think using a contract is an excuse to provide a lower standard of care. There has to be a reasonable assessment, and if a team, if an individual, if a business cannot provide the service that's required, then they really do have to reassess the situation. And I know many colleagues who have left the NHS. I know individuals that have chosen to work in different parts of the NHS that then enable them to fulfil their own professional ethical duties. And it is beholden on us as individuals, I'm afraid. What we can do, though, as a group, and what we should be doing and are doing, is working as a community to try and force those that commission services or design contracts or are setting up services, and of course those services might also be under private provision as well, but ensure that the contracts are all set up to be fair and equitable, both to the patient and the clinician.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, broadening this discussion out a little bit further in terms of challenges and pressures, and I guess it's linked to regulation, what's the latest state of play with regard to amalgam?
Well, we were a little bit concerned recently with China ratifying the Minamata Treaty at the end of August. But we're very hopeful that the situation will remain where we're looking at a sensible phase down of the use of amalgam. Now, the phase down is a very delicate area, and we will need to be able to evidence at some point, you know, that we have reduced the use of amalgam. Certainly, most of us in practice will testify that we're already doing that, whether we're in private practice or NHS. Developments in minimally invasive dentistry, you know, now that's in Picard's manual, it's no longer Black's cavity, you know, we've moved so far away from that. So clinically, we're moving away from amalgam, but there will always be a need, and there should always be the clinician's choice. Realistically, though, as we move forward, as the years progress, and it's really important as a profession that we don't just look at the now and the next 5 years, we need to be looking at 20, 30 years' time, both for our profession and also for our businesses in many respects. But moving forward, we're going to come to a point where amalgam is very expensive just by its very nature. Potentially we will face a ban, we have to be realistic about this and prepared. And ethically, the consent with patients will become more and more complex. And my concern has always been that there will come a point where perhaps it's imposed upon us, a little bit like HTMO 105 was, and the disposal of endophiles, things like that, but on a much grander scale it would be. So my concern was that would happen. So I think we all need to be very alert that this is in the background and this is a very real situation. So as we build our businesses, as we decide on our personal development plans as well, you know, our courses that we go on, as certain individuals have discussions with government, we need to keep this in our mind and ensure that we're not blindsided and that we don't have a situation where either dental practices are fighting for survival if they're NHS, or clinicians are at huge risk of breaching ethical consent guidelines.
Yeah, could you elaborate a little bit on the complexity that you think will be introduced as a result of the change?
On consent.
Yeah.
We could actually have an entire conference based around that when we start to go into it. Consent is often, as you alluded to, inappropriately used as an excuse or elaborated on to do too great a degree. I need to put my teeth in there. But in this situation, I think it's very real that we do have to have a conversation with a patient on deciding what type of restoration they're going to have, and knowing that individual, how much information that individual actually needs. So it comes back to the broader meaning of what is consent, what is meaningful informed consent, and as a concept it actually isn't very difficult, but I think putting it into practice can become very difficult. And again, this comes to time. And so we need to be able to have the time with our patients. We also need to have the skills to be able to offer the different services that may be required. And we also need to have the scope to be able to afford the different materials as they come online as well.
Do you think the NHS can afford a wider range of materials then?
Well, the NHS is merely the commissioner of the service. It is up to individual practices and businesses to decide if the contract remains sustainable for them in the medium to long term, if such a situation arises. And then there is the added complexity that individual clinicians have to take the view as to whether they can work within their own various contracts.
So it's not something you think that the NHS would look sympathetically to in terms of contract values. It would be actually rising costs are rising costs. You have to find a way of dealing with that.
Well, historically, that's certainly in recent years, that's what we have faced in dentistry. And I think if we are aware of the broader pressures that are within the NHS system overall, and also within the UK economy that we're facing, I think we have to be very, very cautious of assuming that just because an external situation changes that that the government and the NHS will step in and help us out. We don't really know what will happen, or you know, it is crystal ball gazing, but I think the important thing is that we're aware of these risks, that we build it into any decision making that goes ahead for individual businesses and individual clinicians, and also as negotiators, as far as we can negotiate these days, that we're alerting government. And I would like to see us having a conversation with patients and the public as well, and alerting them. It's fraught with risk, the whole amalgam debate, because it does rather flush out individuals with very, very strong views. But I think we do need to be brave and have that conversation. It will be even more challenging than it has been in the past because of social media. So I think we're duty bound to sort of man up as such, you know, and take it on, because we need patients and the public to understand this situation, because it is potentially a major change. Longer term, prevention, that's the obvious answer, that's the global answer. In this country, whether it will come fast enough, I really can't answer. I mean, it's certainly nice to have that sugar tax and that drive for improved health overall. But in the meantime, you know, we have to do what we can do immediately.
Do you see the public perception of dentistry and what it has to offer as another one of the key challenges the profession is facing at the moment? There's been some negative press over the last 3 or 4 weeks, which I think were quite interesting in terms of challenging the profession, whether it was the sort of Sunday Times great rip-off. Even the Chief Dental Officer's intervention, when she was apparently, according to the Telegraph, making that comparison with MOTs and using language about don't blindly adhere to the advice your dentist is giving. I thought that was a quite interesting way of approaching what we know is a tricky subject in terms of recall intervals and that different people need different intervals, but to me it felt that publicity wasn't helpful in terms of the public perception of the profession as a whole. But what's your take on all of that?
I think it's important on a number of levels here that we understand that we take great offence in the profession about these things that are being published, but actually it's all gone. Most people will have actually forgotten about it. The undercurrent will be there, and every summer we'll have this churning round. The issues with respect to our CDO in England is a little bit more complex, but again it's due partly to the modern world of sound bites. I mean, on Periscope it was possible via Twitter to be watching it live or recorded, and the actual presentation and discussion is slightly different to the way that it was presented in the Telegraph. Of course, there's no surprise there. The issue, of course, though, is that we are a profession that can offer a great deal to patients and to the public as well. And I think it's time that dentistry ceased to be so isolationist. Partly in my arguments and an urge to get people to think broadly and to be involved broadly in what's going on in the world and in their communities as well, is also for us to be pushing the boundaries of what dentistry actually does, so that we're not just drilling and filling. We have to face facts. The demographics of disease that we're going to be looking at in our population in the UK overall is going to be one of reduced dental disease. We can argue about periodontitis and all of that, you know, for hours and hours and hours. But the reality is that we will be seeing more and more people who don't need any interventive dentistry until perhaps relatively late in their lives. So we have to shift dentistry, and we have to shift the way that we work to accommodate that. There will be pockets of deprivation that desperately need help and support, and we will probably have to argue hard to make sure they get that, because there'll be a very small, discrete group in 20, 30 years' time. But our practices and our practicing lives will look very, very different. We'll have a lot of relatively healthy young people and an awful lot of aged people.
Mm, absolutely. This bit about shifting the perception of dentistry, one of the things I've always found interesting since I've been involved in dentistry is how many people love and trust their own dentist and yet are innately suspicious of everyone else's dentist. And there's something about a disconnect there between the view of the profession as a whole and, as I say, the trust they have in their own dentist, which I think it helps with why some of those bad news stories blow over so quickly, because people are sort of semi-worried on behalf of others, but because it doesn't affect them, because my dentist is great, I don't need to think about it too much. Do you think the profession needs to worry about how it's viewed as a whole? Or actually is the important thing what individual patients think of their own dentist?
That's a really good question, actually, because as a profession, I think we do need to be concerned about our image and our PR. It's common sense. However, on that personal level, you're absolutely correct that patients will have an affinity and build a relationship with their dentist and implicitly trust them until something horrendous happens. But that brings us into a more complex situation, and a more concerning situation, is the way in the last decade, really, we're talking about. We've had a shift away from patients having a direct relationship with their clinician, with their dentist or dental team. In the old days when I first qualified, in the 90s, it was still quite normal that you built your practice list. Patients, a couple of thousand patients would stick with you for 20, 30 years. They would get profoundly upset even if your nurse changed,
yeah,
or if somebody on reception changed. And within a very, very short time span, we're now looking at quite a split. I mean, there's still a large proportion of patients and practices working and receiving care in that way, but we're now seeing a much more consumerist, commoditised, brand-based level of service, especially under the NHS. And whether it's by design or just occurring, the breakdown of that relationship with an individual dentist, and much more of an encouragement on brand, that dentists are interchangeable. I've got quite a few theories about how that relates then to some of the complexities we were talking about earlier on. But generally, I think this huge chasm now between the two types of care, I think it will potentially increase.
Between the two types, in private and NHS, do you mean?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's the use of the individual and building a personal relationship over time, and the transactional, any dentist will do. A little bit like with Tony and Guy. You know,
yes.
They're trained to the same standard, they obviously do the same stuff, it's all the same price, I know how it works, I'm comfortable.
Well, you see, I find this really interesting aspect of the discussion, because I have a vested interest working with a practice plan,
yes,
but you can see that our kind of membership plans support continuity of relationships.
Absolutely.
And longevity of relationships. Most of the patients that have been on plans with us have been there 12, 13, 14 years.
Then all that we were talking about, the issues with complaints, with litigation and risk, are reduced when we've got that relationship. And for the majority of dentists and dental teams, that's very, very valuable to have. And it's why we do dentistry as well. It's nicer work to do when you've got a stable base. But we have to appreciate that there are patients out there, and there are public out there that don't want that relationship. And they are now able to access care in a different way. There are possibly a significant number of patients that are having to access that type of care that would love to have the relationship. I think there will always be those, now that the genie is out of the bottle as such, I don't think we will ever move back to just one model. I think there will always be the variation and the choice. It's just whether it's NHS, whether it's private, whether it one becomes one or the other, I don't think it's that simple, because I think there will be people willing to pay a lot of money just to dip in and out potentially.
Yes, and I think that's really interesting. I think that very much chimes with my view of how things will go, in terms of you end up with a variety of different business models.
Yeah.
And actually one of the challenges for practice owners is going to be, what niche do they want to exploit?
Yeah.
Where do they best fit? Where are they most comfortable?
It could well be that, depending on how the contract is constructed, the NHS contract in England and Wales, and how things develop in the other nations, it could favour one of those above another, but we don't know. But I think just intellectually thinking about it, we have to recognise that there are at least, you know, that we've got the two extremes, everything in between, and it should be a decision, a business decision, and also a personal decision as a clinician, as to if that's how you want your practice, or is that how you want to spend your life working? Because it's relevant for non-practice owners as well.
Absolutely.
To decide where they want to work, where they're going to put their skills to best use, and what they actually want out of their working day.
So I'm finding this discussion really interesting, because we're sort of building a picture of actually an increasingly complex world for the profession.
Hugely complex.
With potentially lots of choices about how they practice, how they care for patients. Where do you see the BDA's role in helping people through this maze of decisions that they're going to have to make?
Well, I think the BDA has appreciated for many years that the world has changed. It changed dramatically for many in 2006. And importantly, the actual demographics of the profession are changing. You know, we've got more women. We're having a completely different approach to practice ownership. So certainly the association, in its most recent strategy document, has highlighted, you know, some key areas where the profession, where the association will be focusing its resources and its energies, and they are the differentiation of the dental industry, is a word that I don't like.
Yeah.
We've had discussions in the past, but the differentiation of service delivery, shall we say, both within the devolved nations and also as we were discussing these different types of models of business. And so there's quite a large piece of work, and there will be a focus on corporatisation of dentistry in all its different forms, and also a very big realisation now and a focus that associates and non-practice owners are the key group, really. I mean, we are facing a world, all things being equal, where we will have an increasing number of non-practice owners, and those individuals have very different needs, but still using the self-employed model are small businesses in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So need to be thinking like as a business, because they are themselves the business out there. So they need to assess a situation, decide what environment they want to work in, decide what their worth is as such, check out the contracts. I think at present we're in a transitional period with non-practice owners, and we need to grasp back a little bit of the self-employed ownership, self-directing. Difficult in the current job market, but not impossible. I think the biggest thing that I would like to see is for my colleagues to actually take back control. And not be seen as second class citizens. We are all clinicians, we're all dentists, we have slightly different roles. And so an associate, in my eyes, is no different to a practice owner. That said, the services that are required will be slightly different, and the BDA are looking at realigning the service delivery.
And what sort of timescales is the BDA working to in terms of that being more visible?
Well, this is part of the 2015-2018 strategy. It's a huge undertaking to actually change the business as such, and that doesn't have to happen immediately. But what we can do is ensure that associates' needs and requirements are strongly represented. And I think certainly with respect to the prototypes and discussions for the new contract, The role of associates, their contracts, their employment status is absolutely key to all discussions. And certainly if GDPC happened to forget at any point, the principal executive committees, especially me, do prod them because it's a key area. Moving forward, our profession is going to look very, very different in 10 years' time, which is a very, very small timescale in the 130-odd years of the BDA. I would like to see that people would want to be a member of their association as well, and that perhaps we move away a little bit from the transactional relationship that we happen to have moved into in the last 15 years or so. And we also desperately need individuals to step up, to get involved locally, to help run local events, also to get involved in committees. I would love to see many more women at BDA committees and at BDA headquarters, because there's a meeting going on today actually, and there won't be very many female faces there.
Well, Judith, I have the feeling we could carry on talking for hours on end, because I found this really fascinating. But thank you very much indeed for giving us your time today and giving us your views. Really appreciate it.
Many thanks, Judith. Absolute pleasure.